Welcome to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, have you ever been to a home show? If you have, you've seen those rival franchises peddling packages of mosquito sprays to homeowners. You ever wonder what's in those sprays and how you can protect your own property? We'll tell you all about it after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Rose, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
I am just ducky today, Rose. Thank you for asking. How are you?
I'm great, except I have a squirrel eating my front porch.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, make sure you use the correct scientific name, Rose. It's evil squirrel.
He's absolutely evil.
Now, where are you, Rose?
Manhattan Township, New Jersey.
Okay, not far from Philadelphia.
Right.
And what is so tasty about your porch?
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out. It was painted about 2 years ago. Previously, it hadn't been painted for many years. The house is old. But after we painted it, within a short time, I noticed these chunks. It's where it steps onto the porch, the last step, and then onto the porch, the best part. I noticed this chunk being taken out. It got bigger and bigger. And I don't know what a squirrel's lifetime is, but it seems it's been over a period of 2 years if one of his buddies is coming back to finish up when he leaves off. But actually, my daughter came over to the house and caught him in the act. She took a picture of him. It looked like a big rat chewing on the porch. And so I have major damage to the front edge of this wood.
Oh,
and
so
how can I deter him?
Okay.
I tried everything.
Well, you know, this reminds me of the time we used to be a rescue home for Great Pyrenees dogs, giant mountain dogs. Uh-huh. And when we had our first one, he got out of the yard and we were having dinner in our dining room with a couple of neighbors. And we heard a commotion outside and we went out. And there's Murphy, the giant Pyrenees, and there's a car driver with his car. And he's going, "Oh, my God, I'm sorry. I didn't see him." And I said, "Oh, my God, did you hit my dog?" And he goes, "Well, no, your dog hit me." And we look, and there is this giant dent in the driver's side door. Murphy had apparently rammed the car. I guess he was going to bring it back home as a souvenir. And I called my insurance company, and when the guy stopped laughing, he said, "We're not even going to charge you a deductible, but we may want to use you in a TV commercial." So my first bit of advice is call the insurance company and see if they laugh hard enough to take care of it for free. But I have a great idea. Now, normally, some of the things we would suggest would be to paint the area with hot pepper sauce or...
Been there, done that.
Okay, to coat it with deer repellent, or some people would suggest covering it with hardware cloth, which is a kind of very finely woven metal fencing. I'm thinking, are these the actual boards that you step down on?
Yes, and it's very, it's in the way of traffic. You are walking on this actively, so it can't be anything that impedes your getting in and out of the house.
Right. So how many boards are affected?
Two.
Okay. What I'm going to suggest is you get a handyman or a carpenter or something like that, and you have them replace those boards with either Trex or ATEC, which are both composite materials made of recycled wood scraps and plastic. They are dense as stainless steel. And then to your delight, and they cut like wood, you can screw them down like wood, they look really nice, they come in a great variety of colors, and I virtually guarantee that an evil squirrel's teeth will shatter before it can bite through a piece of Trex.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. It's one thing I hadn't thought of.
Yeah, my backyard balcony and my potting benches are built of Trex. I have Trex landscape timbers in my garden as raised bed frames that have been there for 35 years, and they're still perfect.
Oh, great. I didn't know Trex had been around that long.
Yeah, well, I think it was relatively new when I built that garden.
Okay. Any tips for getting morning glories off my fence in the back, my wire fence? I think probably in 1943 somebody said, let's plant some morning glories back here. And oh, my gosh, they are stubborn.
What color are the flowers?
Purple.
They are purple. If you just get a hand weeder, a flame weeder, and torch the flowers as soon as they appear, then no seeds will become viable, and that'll be the last year for the morning glory.
Oh, good.
Yeah, that's an annual version, not a perennial.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's just the drop seed that's coming back year after year.
No kidding. It's a lot of seed. Wow.
Yes, it is.
Well, good stuff.
All right, Rose?
Yes, thank you so much.
Our pleasure. You take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Andrew, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being had, Andrew. Where are you, man?
I'm over in Spokane, Washington, dealing with some smoke from all the fires, but beautiful town here.
Yeah, man, I was out in Colorado just like 10 days before their big fires took off. And when you're out in that kind of land, you can see how this blaze could just spread almost forever.
Yes, it goes and goes. We have a lot of hardworking men and women out on the lines, but it is hard to get on top of those when they start catching.
Yeah, and we called our friends who we had stayed with, and our dear friend Jess assured us that their ranch was totally safe, but the smoke was so thick you couldn't go outside.
That's the truth. I live just under a little outcrop in a hill, and usually you can see it on any day. It was so bad about 2 days ago, you couldn't even see it. It's maybe half a mile away. It's just so smoky.
Yeah, it's a sin. Yeah, God bless everybody who's fighting that, and please let these fires go out soon. All right, what can we do for you, Andrew?
Well, I just bought a house a couple years ago, and this year I've been tackling the outside and getting my garden going. My main concern is I planted some Shasta daisies, which I love. They're beautiful, but when the flower starts to die, I understand when you kind of clip them and keep the flower coming back, it's called deadheading, but I understood you had deadhead all the way to the ground, which I've done, and I'm afraid I might have killed that plant. So I'm just curious, how do you deadhead a daisy?
You take it to see an old Jerry Garcia concert at the movies or something, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, you have been correctly informed and misinformed. Deadheading is really important to try to get rebloom on almost any flower. Now, there's some flowers like hydrangeas that are really only going to bloom once, most varieties. But things like roses and daisies, you can coax extra blooms out of them, even if they're not known as repeat bloomers, by constantly pinching off the flower head, the faded flower. And that's called deadheading. What you did sounds more like dead plant killing. You see, what happens when a plant produces a viable flower and then that flower starts to fade? In many plants, that begins the formation of seed set. And once that plant has successfully created viable seeds, it's really not that important for the parent plant to hang around anymore. It's certainly not important for it to have a lot more children. So, you know, the flower bloom slows down or stops. Whereby if you take that flower off and you're just clipping off the flower head or pulling it off, you hold the plant with one hand and pull just the flower off with your thumb and forefinger the other, or again, a pair of pruners, you just want to clip off that faded flower head. And now the plant has not successfully had children. It has not left its DNA for the next generation. So all of its instincts are going to be to keep pumping out more flowers. So
leave the entirety of the stalk and just cut the flower head off itself.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You're doing death pruning.
Okay, yeah. I went all the way to the ground. It was an ugly mess. have I killed this plant then? Is it not going to come back next year?
Let's see. Your climate's kind of weird. I learned that you're not Seattle. I know that you're dry, but you do have pretty strong winters. I don't know. Is there no green growth down at the bottom of the plant anymore?
No, actually, some new little green growth started coming back the week after I cut it. I mean, not much. I don't think it'll get full grown by the time we have winter. But it's still producing some type of green.
Yeah, see, now that's the other issue, is you've kind of pruned this plant in the fall, which is also bad, because that new growth is going to be pretty lush when winter comes. So maybe it'll make it, especially if winter comes on slowly and allows the plant to kind of settle in and be frozen gradually. If you have a sudden cold snap, definitely the plant will die. But now, this is the only way men learn, Andrew. We don't learn by success. We learn from spectacular failure. So in the future,
I had to break down and call you.
Yeah. Now in the future, you're going to be able to save so many plants and get people to have more flowers than they did before by showing them how to correctly deadhead their plants.
I love it. I love it. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, man.
Yeah, you have a good day.
Now it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will speak about the importance of luring bug-eating birds to your garden beds at the American Birding Expo in Oaks, PA on Saturday morning, September 22nd. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to reveal what's in those mosquito sprays they peddle at home shows and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Coming up later in the show, we do a little bit of investigation to find out what's in those sprays that they offer to homeowners to keep their backyards mosquito-free. You'll be surprised at what we found out, but you won't be surprised until we do lots more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Nathan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Nathan. Thank you for asking. How are you, sir?
Outstanding.
And where is Nathan outstanding? And don't say in your yard.
I am in Sunland, California. It's a little bit north of L.A. We get about 5 to 10 degrees hotter on a summer day than L.A. and about 5 to 10 degrees cooler on a winter night.
Oh, okay. Are you inland?
It's in the San Fernando Valley, yeah. So
okay.
It's inland.
All right, good. It sounds like an interesting place. What can we do for Nathan in doubly sunny
Sunland,
California? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So my question is about growing tomatoes. We have sort of a challenging situation here, not only because of the climate, it is very hot here, but also we have a lot of shade. And in some areas that's good, but in some areas that's not so good. For instance, last year I tried to grow a tomato plant in an area that gets shade until about 1 p.m., and then has sun from 1 p.m. to 8 p.m. And I was thinking, hey, 7 hours of sun, that's pretty good. The tomato plant did not do very well in that area. So I was looking around for other areas, and I got a nice area that has a lot of good sun in the morning and then a lot of good shade in the afternoon and a little bit of evening sun. It's not a very big area.
That's okay.
Yeah. So in order to properly rotate them, because I understand that we have fusarium wilt, I believe, I can really only fit three plants there. So I wanted to supplement, and actually I went out and got some big containers. I believe they're about 18 or 20 inches across, so they're pretty big. And I got four of them, and I wanted to grow tomatoes in there. And I bought potting soil, you know, good store-bought potting soil, and I filled them up. And my question number one was, when it comes to containers, do I have to worry so much about the fusarium wilt if it's potting soil from a store and if it's like separated from the garden? Do I still have to worry about the wilt building up if I grow tomatoes in them year after year?
You know, that's an interesting question, Nate. Fusarium wilt, and you're correct, I have verticillium wilt native in my soil. You have fusarium. But they are soil-borne organisms that exist in all soils.
Yeah.
But you're starting out with what we call a sterile medium, and you haven't introduced any of your native soil into the mixture. So this symbiotic relationship where the fusarium organism really thrives in the area of a tomato root zone, How's it going to get there? You know, it's not in that potting soil. If there isn't a little bit of fusarium to get things started, you might have stumbled across something here. No matter what happens, the first year you plant tomatoes in any medium, they should do well. And again, you found out exactly the right thing. Tomatoes want morning sun. They can get by right. with a lot less sun, especially in your conditions where it gets super hot. They can get by with a lot less sun if they get it in the morning as opposed to the afternoon.
Right.
So normally the first year, fusarium would find the roots of your tomato plant. Second year, it would build up. It would begin to replicate. And by the third year, the fusarium would be so populated in the area of the root zone that it would begin to affect your tomato. The lower leaves would begin to turn yellow, and the yellowing would progress up the plant. And the following year, it would happen faster and harsher and probably kill the plant. So no matter what, you don't have to worry for the first 2 or 3 years. I would say in the third year, make sure you grow resistant varieties. Varieties that have the letters V and F indicated on their seed packet or on the plant tag. These are varieties that have been bred to be resistant to these soil-borne organisms. But also, as long as you keep a good distance between the bottoms of these pots in your native soil, and there's no actual ability of this organism to transfer up, it's possible that the wilt will never occur unless it comes in on the roots of the started plants. So we don't, you know, you could control that if you start your own seed. If you're buying,
that's not really an option though.
Yeah. Oh no. Seed starting is very difficult.
You should never really be ashamed of
buying your own plants. Buy them organically grown and locally, and especially in that third and fourth year, just keep an eye out for that yellowing. And if you see it, obviously pull off the yellowed leaves as soon as you see them. But otherwise, don't panic. Use that soil for something else and start fresh with new soil in your containers. At the very least, you're going to get 4 years.
Okay.
I think you should put the containers up on something like bricks or boards, something so that there's a space between them and the ground, just to make sure the fusarium can't sneak in through the drainage holes.
Yeah, I already got them up on something just because we're a little bit below street level, so I wanted to raise them up to get them more sun. Sun is a real issue here.
Okay, good. No, sounds ideal.
So they're already above. They're about, I want to say, like 3 or 4 feet above the ground already.
You know, it sounds like it sounds like it's your game to lose, man.
All right. Okay.
Well, and don't forget, if it does show up, you can use the soil in those containers to grow other plants or give it away. It just shouldn't be used for tomatoes again. But it may never show up in your situation. All right. Good luck, Nate.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
Danielle, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. It's nice to talk to you.
It's nice to talk to you, Danielle. Where are you?
I am in Media.
Just outside of Philadelphia. All right. What can we do for Danielle?
Almost 2 years ago, I had a very large ash tree taken down. I was very sad to lose it. I was concerned about the emerald ash borer, and I had two companies come out and take a look at it to give me quotes for treatment, and they found a lot of problems with the tree, and I was advised that I would just be treating it for a matter of time, and the tree was dying anyway. So we had it taken down. So this was almost 2 years ago, but I still have a whole bunch of the wood chips and the stump grindings in the place where the tree was.
Right.
And I don't know what to do with them. I've used some of them for mulch in the past, but otherwise they're just still sitting there growing mushrooms.
Well, see, and that's it. That's what you have to be careful with. Even though those are what we call arborist wood chips, and they're not treated wood or they're not dyed junk wood mulch or anything like that, they are going to grow mushrooms. And those mushrooms, the mycelium underneath that you don't see, the kind of the root system of the mushroom, that's breaking down the chips into what will become soil, and very good soil. So about how big is this pile?
It's probably about 10 feet by 3 feet, maybe.
Okay.
It's a pretty good size. It was a very large tree.
So there are mushrooms that you could choose to deliberately grow in those chips. There's a company called Fungi Perfecti on the West Coast. A good friend of mine, Paul Stamets, is their mycologist. Even at just at their webpage, which is fungi.com, there's lots of interesting information about which kind of mushrooms grow in which kind of cellulose-rich medium. Some mushrooms grow in straw. Some like to grow on certain types of tree wood. I think there's a couple of edible mushrooms that you can grow in the chips of ash trees. So
I hadn't even thought of that.
That might be fun. Second, you say they've been sitting for 2 years?
Yes.
If you were to get some people over and have a turning party, the bottom center of that pile will be compost.
Okay. And that's usable?
Oh, totally. You know, compost was once wood, was once tree leaves, you know. That's what happens, is it eventually does decay. The perfect use for such material, of course, is to keep down weeds in the lanes between raised beds, if you have a raised bed garden.
We do.
Oh, okay. What do you use in the lanes?
We just let the grass grow between the lanes.
And that's fine, too. Just weed whack it. You know, if you ever decide something different, you can use some of those wood chips. So you would either choose mushrooms or compost. Now, let's say that you want to harvest that compost that is finished. As you turned the pile, you would have ready at your side, collected from Starbucks stores and other coffee shops, you would have about 50 pounds of wet coffee grounds.
Oh, okay.
And as you move that pile from one place to the next, you would mix in those coffee grounds as you go. And then the high nitrogen and the acidity of the coffee grounds with these wood chips that probably appear to be the same as 2 years ago, but they are certainly already in the process of rotting away. The coffee grounds would accelerate the process greatly. And by this time next year, I'd say all or most of the new pile would be finished compost.
Okay. Yeah, it's very spongy when you walk on it now. So it's not the firm pile that it was 2 years ago.
The mushrooms have started the process. And growing edible mushrooms in the pile would also accelerate the breakdown into compost as well. But I guarantee there's compost at the bottom.
Okay. Could I plant another tree in its place?
Did you have the stump?
In that location?
Did you have the stump pulled out of the ground?
No, it was just ground down.
Well, then there's a giant plug in the ground.
Okay. So we would have to dig down underneath all of that compost and get that stump out.
Oh, yeah. Good luck to you with that. Is Superman dropping by for cocktails tonight?
No, unfortunately not.
No, once you get the pile off and you get down to the ground down stump, box it out, make a nice raised bed over top, fill it with soil and plant flowers in it.
Okay.
All right.
That all sounds great. I didn't even think of the mushroom idea of growing mushrooms. That sounds fun. I'm going to look into that, too.
That's why I get the big money.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Dan. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thank you, Bill. Where are you, man?
In Buckingham Township in Bucks County, just about halfway between Doylestown and New Hope, Pennsylvania, near Peddler's Village.
Yeah, oh, I know Peddler's Village. I was going to guess you were near New Hope. Beautiful area out there. Wonderful horse country. All right, what can we do for Bill in Buckingham Township?
Well, I have an apple tree that my young son got me when we moved to this house. It's about 35 years old. It bears apples that are good for cooking. Several years ago, it started getting yellow-brown spots on the leaves, but it weathered through that all right. About 2 years ago, about in late June or early July, it got the same thing, and the leaves started falling off the tree. But new leaves emerged and grew and took over. Last year, almost all the leaves fell off after getting spotted, just like in the fall, and they died. And fewer came back, but they did come back, and it regreened itself before fall. I put a lot of plant tone on the ground under the tree. I don't know if that helped or not.
Now, plant tone, is that the basic natural plant food that the Holly Tone people make?
Yes, it is. I figured it didn't need the acid one like the
Absolutely not. And what time of year did you feed the tree?
In July.
Okay. Don't ever do that again. I mean, luckily you used a natural plant food and not a chemical one. But that's not the time to feed a fruit tree. You would feed a fruit tree in the beginning of the season, just as it's about to leaf out. You don't want to add to the stress of summer or cause a lot of new growth at this time of year.
Okay, I understand. Unfortunately, it happened again this year, and all the leaves are falling off. They're almost all gone, and not much of anything coming back. I did the same thing.
Okay. Is this tree mulched?
No, it's not. There's grass all around it, and it doesn't grow much grass underneath the shady part.
Good, it should not.
Some of the roots show up a little near the surface.
Good, that's good. Is the grass fed, treated with herbicides, anything like that?
I just use a little bit of nitrogen fertilizer on the from Scotts with nothing else in it.
Okay, so that's pretty bad. Do you know the number
for the grass?
Yeah, I know, but what goes on the grass doesn't stay in the grass, Bill.
No, I know.
And nitrogen is the enemy of fruit trees.
Oh.
So how high is the number on the bag? Do you know?
It's probably pretty high. It's probably 22 to 27.
Oh, yeah. Like no. That, yeah. Grass doesn't need anything over 10. These high nitrogen fertilizers, you know, these were originally explosives. And after World War II, they were just put into bags instead of artillery shells. The fact that they can technically feed plants doesn't mean we should be using them. They're tremendously stressful for fruiting plants. So, you know, don't feed your lawn, leave your clippings on your lawn, or switch to a gentle organic lawn food and only apply it in the fall. Let's do something like corn gluten meal. You don't need these high explosives, and the nitrogen is definitely causing all this stress on your tree. It's the enemy of fruiting trees. Now, has the tree ever been pruned or cared for?
Not in the professional sense. Some limbs have died, a couple of big ones, a few smaller ones. Got a hole into the tree at one spot, and I've cut off the dead parts, and it seemed like the rest was all right.
So it doesn't get a yearly pruning or anything the way apple trees are supposed to?
No, just dead limbs cut off. Okay. And cut.
And when the apples form, do you thin them at all?
I let them fall off the tree and let the deer eat them.
Okay. You know, you really can't expect a tree that's not cared for to be healthy. So here's what I'm going to suggest you do. It's probably too late to start a proper pruning regimen. The tree's too big. But do continue to remove dead wood as soon as you see it. If you can see a lot of crowding in one area of the tree, take out good wood if you can do it safely. Do that in the spring, right after growth has begun.
Okay.
Spread compost around the base of the tree, going out from 6 inches away from the trunk to as far out as the drip line goes. And then after the baby apples fall, as safely as you can reach, get up there with a 5-gallon bucket and take off about half of the apples when they're really tiny, when they're the size of a marble. That will strengthen the tree. But I bet you keeping the chemical fertilizer away, opening the tree up a little bit and putting that layer of compost on the soil, I expect that your leaves will be much healthier next year.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. I have a 3-bin composter, and I have lots of compost. I can get it by the wheelbarrow full.
Excellent, excellent. That's the perfect place for it. Apple trees, peach trees, roses, they love compost.
Yeah, I've been using it on the flower beds. I'll use it on the apple tree.
All right. Well, good luck to you, Bill.
Okay, well, thank you very much for those helpful suggestions.
All right. You take care, sir.
Will do. Thank you. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will travel down south to speak about the importance of horticultural therapy when I appear at a benefit for a very special healing garden on Tuesday, October 23rd at the beautiful Country Club of North Carolina in Pinehurst. But don't go checking the events section of our website for all the details just yet, because we'll be right back to reveal what's in those mosquito sprays they peddle at home shows and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
in just a little bit. We will reveal what we have learned about those packages of mosquito spraying different franchises sell to homeowners. But before that, a couple more of your franchised phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Thurston, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mr. McGrath. How are you? It's so nice to actually be on the line with you. I'm a big fan.
Oh, thank you. Where are you, Thurst?
I am calling you from the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Where in Philadelphia are you?
I work at an elementary school, and I also live in West Philadelphia, near Market and 63rd, actually.
Okay, sure. I know the neighborhood. All right. What can we do for you?
I wanted some advice because I am a sixth grade mathematics and science teacher, and I am interested in getting a school garden started as a project for some science students, but I don't just want to have just something growing. It is important to see something growing, but what I want more importantly is to have something that will bear some type of fruit or vegetable or something that we can pick off of that tree, take in the classroom, season it, and eat it, and enjoy the fruits of our labor, as it were. And I was wondering what types of plants will be, you know, relatively low maintenance, you know, last through the off season when we're actually not in school, and be okay to go from year after year bearing something that we can bring into the classroom and enjoy tasting.
Okay, so obviously the gardening year in Philadelphia is the opposite of the school year. Matter of fact, you probably know the school year was designed to make sure that the kids were available to help out on family farms and do vegetable gardening chores. So, you know, the seasons are diametrically opposed. Now, you're in a heavily urban area. You're talking about growing stuff in the ground outside?
Yes, sir.
First thing you got to do is get your soil tested for lead and other contaminants. Most urban soils are heavy-duty filled with lead, mercury, other contaminants that it would be really dangerous for the kids to disturb by digging up the soil and working in it. So you can contact your local extension agent and then arrange to have some soil samples sent to Penn State. That is the Pennsylvania State Soil Testing Lab. And be aware that it's probably going to come back as too dangerous for the children to work in. So,
okay.
Yeah, and forget trees. Fruit trees are the highest maintenance. And, of course, things like tomatoes and peppers and stuff, they're going to grow when the kids aren't there. So they're not going to get much of a lesson from that. I have two options for you, especially since you're a science teacher. For a small investment of some packs of seeds and some seed starting mix, a sterile mix, and some, I used to say fluorescent lights, but now they have LED lights that are in the shape of old school fluorescents that give off a lot of lumens and are very inexpensive to run. You could teach the kids how to start their own plants from seed. And then at the end of the school year, they could go home with a tomato plant, a pepper plant, a cucumber plant, something like that, that either the house they live in or a friend or a relative could grow with them over the summer, and then they could come back and share the bounty that's coming in now. But you would have taught them an amazing skill in seed starting, which is very different than gardening. And that's a skill that would give them an amazing head start on anybody else who wants to garden. The other options, if you find out your soil is workable outside, it's safe, or if you want to have somebody build raised beds over top that, you know, kind of cut off that nasty soil and, you know, get those filled with compost or something like that. The two things that I urge school gardens in the Northeast to do is on the very first day of school, you could plant garlic. You can go to a farmer's market, use a catalog, and get planting garlic. And every kid could, depending on the size of the garden, plant a single clove or plant a head full of cloves. And then they could watch the green sprouts come up. And in the spring, when those sprouts get larger, you could actually clip those off and the kids could taste them. They have a very light garlicky scent. But all things being equal and with a little bit of luck, at the very last day of school, they could pull up their own head of garlic from every clove they planted. And then you guys could make a garlicky dish in the school cafeteria, or again, they could take it home to somebody in the family who cooks. The other alternative, which is just for pretty but is just as much fun, is they could each plant a spring bulb in the fall. They could plant a tulip or a daffodil or a crocus, and then in the spring, they would see their flowers come up. Then they would observe the flower, and then when the flower was finished, they could clip off the seed head, let the green leaves turn brown, and then dig up the bulb that's underground, and then they would have a spring bulb to plant that fall either at home or in the school garden again.
Wow, okay.
Those are all things that lean into the school year as opposed to fighting it.
Okay, I took notes on all of that, so first thing I'm going to do is get in touch with the extension and get that soil tested. I'm going to hopefully get that process started immediately, and we'll move forward with whatever we find from there. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Good luck to you, sir. Jen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Jen. How are you?
I am fantastic.
And where is Jen fantastic?
In Rhode Island.
Oh, okay. What can we do for Jen up in New England?
Well, we moved into a new house in September. They had just put in a brand new septic system in, on the property. So over the winter and the spring, we looked at it. It had a huge kind of sinkholes all around the caps for the tank. I called the septic company that installed it. They came and they just like dumped a bunch of sand, of dirt. It's clay-like kind of dirt all around the septic system. And it's right in our front yard, right in the middle of our front yard. It looks terrible. So my husband and I were talking about putting like a garden there, but I was reading all these things online about not planting over a septic. You should do just grass. But then I was reading you should do just annuals, but then something said don't do annuals. So I don't know. I was going to do this garden. I just don't know if it's one okay to do. And if I do do it because of all the clay, and do I just dig a hole, put...
No, you don't do... No. Is this your first experience with septic?
Yes.
Okay. There's a lot of mistakes you can make when you deal with these things.
Okay.
Do you have a sand mound, or is it flat?
No, it's flat.
It's flat. Okay, so you have an underground storage tank, and then you have perforated piping that runs out from that as your drain field. And there's also, I guess you're saying the area where the dirt settled down, there are some giant pipes coming up that can be used as emergency cleanouts. If anything okay. goes wrong, that's another way to access the contents of the tank.
Okay.
So that doesn't tell us anything about where the drain field is. You don't want to damage those pipes. Now, one of the reasons that grass is indeed the ideal plant for this situation is it doesn't have the kind of roots that are ever going to damage your piping, your drain field, your septic system, because you don't want anything to come back into the house that you think you had sent out on a one-way ticket.
So, no, I don't.
Yeah, exactly. And grass is probably the heaviest feeder you could imagine. And in times of heavy use or heavy rains, when that drain field is working high, there are some nutrients that are being released to the surface. So grass thrives on those nutrients, which, you know, let's be honest, we're talking humanure.
Mm-hmm.
Grass thrives on those nutrients and actually utilizes them in a way that protects nearby waterways. I can't think of anything that would be better and or safer, not only for the field, but for the environment. And, you know, if you could get a map of the drain field and you could say with authority where the furthest pipes are, you might be able to do some plantings around the edges. But the last thing you want to do is crack a pipe or plant something whose roots are really going to infiltrate the system. Yeah, the idea is you don't want to be digging, you don't want to disturb it, just gentle mowing when needed. So I know it's not what you want to hear, but my advice would be to Did the people who did the work, the septic work, also reseed the lawn?
No.
Who did?
We had someone who came and did the seed, but I watered, kind of managed the whole thing. But no, okay. So yes, someone else did.
Okay, but you can still contact that person.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So what you want to do is find out the exact seed they used and buy some more of that. And this is the perfect time of year for you to, quote, overseed it in these bare areas.
Okay.
Just sow the seed right on top of the areas you see this new dirt, cover it over with a little compost or soil, and it should fill in nicely. And the reason you want to ask and buy the exact same name brand seed is so that it matches the existing grass perfectly.
Right. Okay. So that's just the whole dirt area I just reseed.
Yes, and if it's if you get the exact same grass seed that they use, it should blend in perfectly, and this is the mm-hmm. perfect time of year to plant it. You're right on time.
Okay, so no plant, no garden.
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right,
good luck, Jen.
I appreciate it. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week, which we are calling, with apologies to Jimi Hendrix, "Hey, Joe, what's in that mosquito spray in your hand?" Brett Rader, barely old enough to know who Jimi Hendrix was, producer of You Bet Your Garden, would you please read this very important question?
Sure. Barbara in Wallingford, Pennsylvania writes, "I'm a longtime listener of your show and really appreciate all that I've learned from you. But now I have a problem. We have a small lot with gardens, including a vegetable garden, all organic, composting, the whole bit. We also love wildlife and get a surprising number of birds and other animals. One of my favorite sounds in the summer is crickets singing. Now enter the villain, or what I think is the villain. Our neighbor, who is a very nice woman, has taken to hiring a company called Mosquito Shield. They spray all over her yard, including the plantings along the adjoining fence line, so that the spray comes into our yard a little bit, and of course the vegetable garden is right in the line of fire. This is very upsetting to us, as we do not want to have problems with a good neighbor or pesticides on our food. I also suspect that something is happening to the insects and maybe even birds due to the spray. Our neighbor on the other side found a dying hummingbird in his lawn the day after Mosquito Shield had sprayed. The fireflies were far fewer in number this year, the cicadas have not made a sound, and the crickets are almost silent. I see this company's signs and those of similar outfits going up in other yards, and I am terrified that we'll see a whole lot of wildlife, including our beloved bees, dying out in our area. Do you know anything about the chemicals Mosquito Shield uses? Is there a way to get information on the safety or lack thereof regarding this type of spraying? We are very upset about this and would appreciate any thoughts or suggestions you can offer."
Well, I've been researching this company online ever since I received this email a couple of weeks ago, and information about the ingredients in their sprays has not been forthcoming. Other online reporters also seem to have been stonewalled, sometimes to the point of forming conspiracy theories.
Could you find out anything about the company?
Yeah, it's a national franchise that has locations in most of the East Coast states and west to Nebraska. Many of the websites dealing with the companies are solicitations to buy a franchise. Some are offers of spray packages to homeowners with lots of assurances and testimonials, but no list of ingredients.
Do the websites claim safety?
No, they're not allowed to do that.
Is this level of secrecy normal?
Well, it doesn't seem to be. A similar franchise called Mosquito Joe is very upfront about their options. They offer a choice of what they call a, quote, barrier spray of pyrethroids, a very common chemical insecticide, or an all-natural alternative spray that only remains effective for 2 weeks as opposed to 3 weeks for the barrier spray.
Does Joe reveal what's in his all-natural spray?
Not directly, but it's really safe to assume that it's a mix of the botanical oils that have been shown to be effective mosquito repellents. That's what the Mosquito Shield people say makes up 99% of their product.
What? You know what's in what they're spraying?
Yeah, I just called one of the local franchises and told them I was preparing for an outdoor wedding and wanted to know what was in their spray. Now, it was a little tough getting the information, but they claim the spray is, quote, 99% vegetable oil plus, again, quote, a very small amount of a chemical pesticide. Specifically, they said 1 ounce in every gallon of their mix.
All right, let's see. We've got 16 ounces on a pint. You carry the 4.
There are 128 ounces in a gallon, Brett. So the chemical pesticide makes up a little less than 1% of the spray, which can still be an enormous amount. Many pesticides are lethal at half that concentration. Now, the, quote, vegetable oils they identified include garlic, cedar oil, lemongrass, and peppermint, all of which make sense.
Do those botanical sprays have a history?
Yeah. Back in the early 1990s, organic California growers were using garlic oil to try to control pest insects. Their workers soon noticed that they weren't getting all bit up anymore. Tests were run, and garlic barrier began being sold as a mosquito preventative. Cedar oil soon followed, both alone and in mixes, as did the lemon-scented herbs and peppermint. I actually used the original mosquito barrier garlic spray to solve a huge mosquito problem in a series of operas being performed outdoor in Fairmount Park years ago. It worked so well that people were calling up. They were afraid we were spraying toxic chemicals in the park. Our listeners should send a formal letter or email to the service asking them to cease their overspray, which is illegal. I would also ask to be notified in advance of each treatment so I could hang a tarp on the fence that day. Long term, they should be able to convince that neighbor to simply hire a different service that only uses botanicals. Or they can offer to set up BTI traps on both properties. That's a much more sensible way to prevent mosquito problems. Well, that sure was some interesting information about mosquito spraying now, wasn't it? Luckily, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over at your leisure or leisure, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week, and you will always find the latest question of the week at the Gardens Alive website. Yikes, my producer is threatening to spray my succulents if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
Please include your location. Oh, please, please, please.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all those garden questions you were going to ask us, audio of this show, past shows, and our priceless podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our vice president of production is Terry Murray. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Our engineer is Al Banks, and our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and stay current with the show at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website bite-free. Editor Al Banks says he gives more blood to mosquitoes than to the Red Cross. Our producer, Brett the Viking Raider, wears a cross made of garlic when he goes outside. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'm so mean I bite the mosquitoes back. And that's why I'll be here to see you again next week.